Hello and welcome to the second episode of Satoshi's Mind, brought to you by Nakamoto. On Satoshi's Mind, we discuss recent trends in the blockchain, DLT and Web3 space and some of the applications in other industries with experts that are currently working on those ideas and concepts. Yeah, my name is Florian. I started working in the blockchain ecosystem at like the end of 2013, worked with a couple of different projects, then got involved with Advanced Blockchain, where I did a bunch of business development stuff. And currently I'm really interested in tokenization and some of the new technologies that are now coming out of blockchain and some of the new use cases that are currently being developed. Yeah, and here's my co-host, Connor.
Hey, Florian. I'm Connor Kvyatchyn. I'm a comedian, audio person, and a newcomer to the blockchain, DLT, and Web3 space. I'm here to be myself and ask the questions, especially newcomers like myself might have. And I was actually trying to rack my brain to figure out what I was up to in 2013 when you were getting involved in this space. I was running track. That's what I was up to. Jeez. What's going on with you, Florian?
Not much. I'm currently at my parents' house due to like some family events, like birthdays and stuff.
Very fun. And
planning to go to the US in like a month, like depending on how it goes with all the quarantine things.
Nice, nice. Who's our guest on today?
So our guest in this episode is Paul Kohlhaas. He was the director of business development at Consensus. Then he started his own software as a service development company called Lenum Labs. And currently he's the CEO and co-founder of Molecule Protocol. Yeah, and you can find him on Twitter under @PaulKHLS. Yeah, and welcome to Satoshi's Mind, Paul.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, Florian. Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Kohlhaas. Really excited to be on the show with you today.
We're excited to have you.
Yeah, to jump into it. Like, what's the story of how you got involved in like blockchain and the whole industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So growing up as a person, I've always been really interested in fair systems for people. There's a famous book by a German author, I think it was written in the 17th century, 18th century, called Michael Kohlhaas, which is essentially a story about this knight that I think he crosses a bridge and like his horses get seized while he crosses like from one town to the other. And back then in Europe, you really had these feudal systems where like a lord would own a specific part of land. And so this concept of a social contract, like what was right and fair, really didn't exist back then. And this guy, Michael Kohlhaas, just thought it was really unfair that his horses got like taken away on a whim. And then like he rallies his people and like goes out and like burns down a couple of towns of like the feudal lords that had stolen his horses. And it's essentially a story of like a guy that wasn't happy with like his social contract being broken. And there's actually this big political debate about social contracts by guys like Rousseau. So these are really concepts that started coming up in the 18th, 19th century. And then, coming back to me, so I've always been interested in fair systems. And during high school, I got very interested in open source biotech research that was really blossoming up at the time, specifically around new psychedelic research, which has really become very prominent in the past couple of years as more and more biotech companies and even large scale organizations like MAPS in the United States are exploring these compounds for novel uses as antidepressants for PTSD. So I got really interested in that scene because back then it was all online. Like there was massive Reddit threads, different forums where people were openly discussing these things. And then at the same time, due to a family friend who was affected by this, by the opiate crisis in the US, which also simultaneously started unfolding, I really started asking myself the question, like, how can it be that we have this big pharmaceutical system that is so unfair to people in terms of the drugs that are put on market by big pharma. And then at the same time, started comparing this to this very open source, fringy psychedelic research community that essentially did exactly the same thing as pharma, which is namely like investigating different compounds for their potential uses as therapeutics. So I found that a really interesting early thesis. I then went on, I studied economics and international affairs in Switzerland. So I'm originally a Swiss. And there, through a couple of friends, I started trading biotech stocks and NASDAQ stocks. So really started getting a little bit into tech. And then we had a person in that group. So this was like early, mid 2013, who said, hey guys, we should take a look at Bitcoin. As a friend of mine who was at the time interning at one of the first Bitcoin exchanges in Europe, which is a Bitcoin Swiss. And he kind of brought this idea into the group. Hey guys, I still remember the day. It was like a sunny afternoon. We were like chilling at a friend's house doing our studies. And he said, let's look at Bitcoin. And I started looking at it and became really, really interested. And then attempted to write my bachelor's thesis on this topic and messaged like, emailed all of our finance professors and everyone turned me down and just said like, this is a scam and a Ponzi. But at that point, the bug had kind of bitten. And I finished my studies, got really interested in game theory, but then got deeper and deeper into this like early blossoming crypto community. It was also around the time that concepts around more complex blockchains like Ethereum first started emerging. And then really kind of just went deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole. Briefly worked in private equity. And then as I was working there, this is early 2016, Ethereum really started taking off. And then quickly decided to quit my job and start my first company. Basically out of the reason because no one was doing anything in the space. I mean, again, this is like early 2016. I still remember like trying to work the Mist wallet that the Ethereum Foundation had put out. And I mean, Ethereum at that stage was like a burning tire fire. This is like, I think the DAO launched like 6 months later. But yeah, I started my first company back then purely because no one was doing anything. And then through that company, worked on a project with UNICEF and their innovation fund. And so we were consulting lots of early corporates around how they could build Ethereum-based pilots. Also met Simon de la Rouvière during that time, who was one of the very early employees at ConsenSys. And really, I think, one of the founding fathers of bonding curves and automated market makers. And through him, then got in touch with ConsenSys. The application that I was working on with UNICEF was focused on digital identity. So then I joined Uport, which was really one of the first identity protocols that was being built on top of Ethereum by ConsenSys, and then worked 1.5 years at ConsenSys. And during that time, also started interacting a lot with early concepts around token engineering, specifically around data marketplaces. So it's really inspired by Ocean Protocol. And I had this brief moment when I was really going deep into the Ocean Protocol architecture, like late 2017, where I realized, hey, some of these principles around how we can incentivize companies, enterprises to put their data into an open network and be incentivized through it to train up AI models, for example, how some of this network thinking could be reapplied to pharma. Yeah, started building out this idea of Molecule, and in the fall of 2018, left ConsenSys, and then started building out Molecule.
Seems like with a lot of people in this space, the idea is very philosophical and idealistic when they get started, and it's a very beautiful idea that inspires a lot of people, and that's what I'm learning as I learn more about this space. But you had mentioned you worked at ConsenSys. What is ConsenSys all about, and what did you do there when you were there?
ConsenSys is a lot of things to a lot of different people, I suppose. I think it was one like when I ConsenSys when I joined the company, and this was early 2017. Was really like my dream company to work at in the blockchain space. I think they were thought leading on many different topics. They were tackling a broad range of blockchain use cases. I think I joined the company when it was just over 100 employees, and then it grew up to just under 1,400 within the course of like a year. And it was really interesting to see. So Consensus was really built on like this very open organization style that was trying to embrace the core concepts of blockchain, where every member of Consensus was a node in the network. And there was a really flat hierarchy, and across Consensus, a consensus mechanism. So Consensus is actually short for consensus systems. And
I always got confused about that, because there's like a consensus, like protocol is that the thing, and then there's the company too, right? So that's that. I was watching one of your videos and you said Consensus is this company. I was like, wait, I thought it was a thing that people needed to come together in order to move things forward. So it was very eye-opening for me.
I guess that's what they really embraced as a company. I mean, a consensus system is just a rule system that people kind of agree on. Like our legal system, in a way, like our modern legal system is a consensus system where we've come to consensus to agree to adhere to a common rule set, the same way that Bitcoin has an underlying consensus mechanism. I guess the name was the game back then. I think as happens with many companies that grow very quickly, very fast, if you have that coupled with a flat hierarchy, that can also lead to a lot of challenges as you scale a company. But it was an extremely interesting place to work. I'll be forever grateful for Joseph Lubin and the team for like hiring me back then. And I think it's often underestimated how much Consensus has done for the ecosystem, because they really went out there and started building so many core components without wanting to monetize them. I think like building developer suites like Truffle, building things like MetaMask, which today is still like the most widely used Web3 browser and transaction signing tool. And they did all of that because they believed in like it was the right thing to do. If you scale a company like that in that time frame, it can also lead to a lot of challenges. But I think Consensus has weathered them extremely well over the time, and I'm also extremely interested and excited to see what they're going to be building in the future.
You said something real quick. I just want to clarify an Ethereum ecosystem. What exactly is that for people that might not understand? And how did like Consensus help shape a lot of, you know, the ecosystem? Because I understand it's still fairly new. I know 2.0 is starting to launch up, but what exactly is an Ethereum ecosystem?
That's a good question. I guess an ecosystem is composed of different stakeholders and that are trying to drive a common cause forward. And in the beginning, the Ethereum ecosystem was really the Ethereum Foundation that through their initial ICO was endowed with a lot of resources. But now that ICO obviously distributed ownership in the network, and now you're left with maybe 500 people that have very vested interest to begin driving Ethereum as a network forward and start building an ecosystem. And then I think an ecosystem really comes to life once you start allowing people to operate with the underlying protocol that you're building in a relatively open way. So then people started building developer tooling. Different people started building wallets. People started building companies because suddenly they sat on a pile of Ether that had appreciated enormously. And they were like, cool, you know, actually, I'm going to start my own company with this. And I think the very open design and the open source ethos of systems like Ethereum allow these ecosystems to kind of blossom and come to life, where then the stakeholder groups are comprised of developers. They're users of the applications that those developers are building. They're comprised of speculators and investors that drive up the price of the asset, but they try to do that in a long-term view and sustainable way. Then you start having regulators, you start having legal firms that start looking, wait, but is this actually all legit? Where are some of the issues here? You start having entrepreneurs that start building companies with these applications using those developers, and really starting to take, I guess, what Ethereum is trying to be as an underlying protocol into the real world. So I don't know if that fully answered your
question. Yeah, it makes sense. It seems like a playground. You're adding more and more pieces as you go. And then it continues to grow from there.
Yeah. And you're letting people operate relatively freely. It's like in some sense the internet is an ecosystem in that sense, because it's an open protocol that people can build applications around. And I think in many sense, if you compare these blockchain systems to like the internet, I think we're still very much in the early days, like early 90s. If people complain around gas with Ethereum, so for example, maybe for some of the listeners that don't know, so Ethereum is essentially like a distributed computer, and you pay that computer in gas, and then that computer will execute a certain transaction for you. In the same way that if I'm running an app, that app will be running on a server in California, and that server has been set up by someone, they incur costs. So and say, now you're kind of paying for this distributed computer. And for example, if people complain about like gas cost, it's kind of like complaining about dial-up internet in the 90s and saying, we're never going to be able to do video calls on the internet because my dial-up line barely gets me 1 kilobyte. But see where we are now.
One thing I was also wondering, with consensus, you were also working on like a proof of concepts for companies, right? And like also later on with Linum Labs, like what would you say is like for especially Ethereum, like a good like applications to build stuff with, and like what's the process that behind like building those proof of concepts or even pilots?
Very good question. So as kind of these ecosystems were growing, lots of enterprises also started getting interested. And I actually think specifically something that Ethereum and also consensus did extremely well was to start building enterprise ecosystems where that ended in things like Quorum, which was run by one of the largest banks, JP Morgan. You had the Ethereum Enterprise Alliance. So there you're creating ecosystems for enterprises specifically to begin exploring these POCs. And for enterprises, it's often quite difficult because they're like, well, there's this really cool new concept. How can we start playing around with it? And I think one really important thing to understand with building a POC or even a pilot is how an enterprise actually works internally. So internally, you will have some innovation manager that is bitten by the bug, or he's drank the Kool-Aid and he's like, let's really do this. And this guy now needs to get sign off from his manager, who is like, okay, our crazy innovation manager wants to do something again. And then let's give him a small budget. You know what? Maybe something will come out of it. And then we all look good in the end. So these people are within a large organization and they're all trying to look good. And I think that's something really important to realize, like, well, how do the politics work in this? And so you try to help this innovation manager create a first success that works to his upper manager so that the innovation manager will get a bigger budget. So maybe he has 50,000 to put into a first POC. And if that works, you know what? Maybe actually he gets 500,000. And then those things slowly start scaling up. So I think that's something really important to understand if you want to successfully work with companies, like how do the politics work and like what is their goal on the other side? Because they're probably not going to put their entire system onto a blockchain next year or like tomorrow or like in a couple of weeks, but like slowly, how do you get them there? And then I think within that, a really important component is that they do skills development within the organization. So something that we put a very strong focus on with Linum Labs then is that we started proof of concepts, but they were very closely coupled with training and skills development. And almost giving them a plan of you guys need to hire your own developers and you guys need to start training them, because only if you do that, you can actually get on a sustainable path to engage with this. Mm. We try to like set up a POC or a pilot and then remove ourselves, because once you move past that stage of trying to build something production ready with a large enterprise, it's a really difficult thing, because then you need to start getting into the politics of that company and overcome all of those hurdles. From an application perspective, I mean, the space is so wide in terms of what you can do with blockchain in different industries. We worked a lot with banks initially. So a lot of our POCs were focused around financial applications. The very, very early days of DeFi, specifically, for example, with banks, if you tell them, well, like you can, you will have interoperable wallets and people won't need bank accounts anymore. They're like, what? But this erodes our core business. And then, but so you also need to be aware of that they don't necessarily want to do something that erodes their core business away, even if it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think JP Morgan just invested like $50 million in like Consensus, right?
Yeah, that was an interesting development. So I know JP Morgan and Consensus have been working very closely for years on Quorum. And Quorum is essentially like it's like an enterprise Ethereum chain that had a lot of components that enterprises would typically want, being like transaction privacy so that you can't see everything. Also, I think JP Morgan included like the role of a central bank in the system, that a central bank could view all the transactions. And then I think what happened through that, as a business relationship evolved, Consensus and JP Morgan were working very closely together to the point where JP Morgan realized, hey, it would be better to kind of spin off Quorum into an open structure like Consensus with their developers, where the speed of innovation could happen a lot quicker. Because now, thinking back through the POC or pilot concept that we talked through, because you're removing that the politics, and you can kind of start innovating a lot more freely.
I think you're pointing out something that is really important. It took me a little bit to overcome is that the fact that the crypto space, as you know, widely referred to when I'm talking with friends and stuff like that who aren't involved, isn't just coins, isn't just the Bitcoin and all of that. It's so much more. Can you explain in a really top level way? Because I know it's a lot to unpack, like a little bit of what this technology can actually do that's more than just the coins. You're touching on it a lot right now, but everything you're saying is like, oh yeah, this crypto is so much bigger than what people actually think it is who aren't involved in the space.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one big turning point for me when I started looking at Ethereum was this, I think I touched a little bit on it earlier, was this notion of like a decentralized computer. And we have to say, when you open up your laptop, you have an operating system running on that computer. And most of the apps that you're running will be running locally on the machine. But increasingly, we tend to use apps that are running externally somewhere on a server. So if you open up your phone will connect to a server. You open up the Facebook app, it'll connect to a server in California that is actually running your app. And so this is how the world works today. But that obviously comes with a ton of problems because we don't own our data anymore. Our data is being mined. You have zero control over, like Facebook could decide tomorrow to turn off your account. Same for Google. Imagine, I mean, almost all of us use Google extensively.
Yeah.
For pretty much everything that we do. Imagine if Google, for some reason, decided you're a political activist and decided to turn off your account. There's nothing that you could do. And so what I found really interesting about this notion around Ethereum was we can have the same applications, but had them running on a decentralized network, which now means instead of it running on a server in California, it's running on this network and it's running in a completely trustless manner. So no one can shut it down. And I can trust it. It's immutable. I mean,
the trustless meaning people don't trust it. There's not a trust overseeing it, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, people have gotten burnt with that notion as well. I think the DAO in 2016 as the one big example. So time and time again, we see these decentralized applications being hacked, but that's not necessarily because the network isn't working. Like if there's a hack on Ethereum, you can't say like, well, Ethereum got hacked, which often in the early days people did, or like my Bitcoin got hacked. It's often that like either someone found a loophole in the code, but within the system that's completely legitimate in a way. But maybe to come back to your high level question, like think of instead of our apps running on a server in California, they now run on a decentralized network where the users are in full control. And also where you can start taking ownership of your data and taking ownership of your financial assets. In the same way that think of banks are really running applications for our money. So if you log into your bank account, you're logging onto the server of the bank that is running your e-banking app. Again, the bank tomorrow, for whatever reason, can decide to shut down your account. And like it happens to, I see people posting this on Twitter fairly often. And so that's, I think, fundamentally one of the most powerful concepts. And then you can ask, like, what can I do with it? Well, you can almost do anything that we can do in our modern digital space but we can now do it in a decentralized way and really give power back to users.
Yeah, and another thing I also wanted to touch on and talk about is, so you were initially pretty interested in biotech when you were younger, and then you kind of took your learnings from consensus with building an ecosystem, working in the token economics, etc., and the experience from other software as a service stuff, and then built Molecule. Can you tell us something about what you're doing with Molecule? And
yeah, absolutely. So I think pharma is a lot of things, but it's a really fundamentally broken market. It's a market that has seen very little innovation in terms of how the fundamental business model works. So pharma is one of the last big pipeline industries. But what a pipeline industry is essentially, so how do taxi companies work? Imagine you want to start a taxi company. Normally, in the early days, you would have to buy a bunch of cars. So you start your company, you buy a bunch of cars, and then you hire a bunch of drivers, and then you put out articles in a newspaper, say like Joe's Taxi, and then people call you up, and that's almost your pipeline. Like you acquire the assets and you put them together, same as in manufacturing, and then you sell something to an end to a client. And so pharma really works in the same way, in that they research drugs and then they create a lot of data about them. They get FDA approval and then they produce them and market them. And it's a really long process. So in today's system, it can take up to 10 to 15 years to bring a drug to market from initial concept. And you have to imagine how long that is. Like 15 years ago, we didn't have the iPhone. and look where we are today. But for a drug company, that's how long it takes them even to just bring one thing to market from an idea perspective. And then it costs them upwards of $2.5 billion per drug.
And then we still see things the opioid crisis and all of that, which in a lot of ways is because of big pharma and all that. Like, it's not always the most effective thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is like a pipeline. You have an idea and then you drive it through these different stages and then you do marketing and distribution. But what's happened over the past couple of decades is pharma has become increasingly less risk-prone. And it has to do a lot with how the financialization of pharma, like in the late 90s, Wall Street really started taking off. So stuff started becoming a lot more short-term focused. Like, we have to drive results. And so instead of investing a lot into R&D and research, pharma companies increasingly started doing M&A, which means they today acquire a lot of their early innovation from biotech companies and then bring them to market. And one of the big problems there, or why it's so expensive, is because everything is done in-house. So imagine this concept of science. Science should ideally be shared and people should be able to talk about it. But now a pharma company has all the science, keeps everything in-house. And if things don't work, they don't communicate that. Because why would they? If I'm a drug company developing something, why would I tell the public that, sorry, this drug isn't working? So if you had an open system around it, people could easily say, hey, there might be a problem here and this is probably not going to work. So as a pharma company, I only have an incentive to tell people about the stuff that works. So you have, you have clinical trials that are being run, for example, on a new compound. You might run 50 trials and 3 of the trials had positive data. You can burn the 47 ones that didn't work and you can only show the 3 ones that worked. And now a drug advances in this cycle and then fails later, which is really expensive now, because everything that fails in this inefficient cycle gets offloaded to the consumer as an end cost. I'm starting on a very high level here, but I started looking at this really obsessively, and fundamentally, what pharma is really two things: it's data and IP. Sorry, did you want to ask something, Connor?
No. I was just I appreciate it. That's what I was going to say. I'm glad you're starting here. Because I was researching this, and I'll be honest, my roommates are some of the people that are on the fence, and I'm like, about it, because they think coins. That's all they think about. I'm like, no, this research is actually impacting and very disruptive in an industry that needs to be disruptive. Like, there's so much more going on. So I'm glad you're explaining the inefficiencies so that way people can understand, oh no, there's so much more here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so fundamentally what we thought about was like, how can we move from a pipeline that is really broken, but no one knows how to change it? And like, there's been like, people have been writing about this for years, how broken pharma is. And there doesn't seem to be a solution. And there's been attempts to like fully open source pharma where you say, you know what? So there's a really interesting group of academics and universities that are running a project called Open Source Pharma, where they're actually using GitHub to research drugs in the open without patents. And now the problem is you can do that, and they've actually been successful. So they're researching malaria drugs, new antibiotics, tropical diseases. But the problem is if you develop a drug fully open source and you don't patent it, then no one has an incentive to now pay for the high cost of research because you can't really commercialize it well. And so to bring this kind of back together, what we thought is, how do we turn a pipeline model into a marketplace? And this is really a trend that has been in so many other industries. You think of, I spoke about taxis earlier, think of Uber. Uber turned taxi into a marketplace. And so what we're trying to do is turn that pipeline into an open marketplace. And what that means is really two things. We look at pharma as data creation. So these are like the clinical trials, and then IP. And something where blockchain has been extremely efficient as a use case is in tokenization. So creating coins in a way. And so the easiest way to describe what we're trying to do at a high level, so we're trying to build a marketplace where we're connecting researchers, scientists, and biotechs. So really people that are developing these early drug ideas and allowing them to upload them onto an open platform that could look a bit interface similar as an Airbnb. An Airbnb, you upload your apartment and then someone wants to book it. So you upload your idea for a new molecule. And then on the other side of the marketplace, you have pharma companies, you have investors, biotech VCs, you could have patients that now want to fund and help the development of these therapeutics. And the kind of what brings them together in our model is this tokenization of IP. So essentially turning the IP, which is really the core value driver, into a coin. but then there's obviously so much more to it, because now these coins or markets that we're creating now start living off of the research data. So positive data comes out, something might appreciate in value. Negative data comes out, it would depreciate. And so we're really trying to create this new innovation engine.
That's so fascinating. It really is. I know we're running low on time. I have one more question. I don't know if you have any more after Florian, but I was actually curious because I know people can buy into this. I think you're at the early stages of that right now. That's correct, where people can actually start? Or is that, if people were to, you know, support some research or something to invest, you know, in drugs, and should people be thinking about it in that way, like as an investment, or how should people think about it? And is there a return for the investment if it is thought that way?
It really depends on the setup. So we're exploring concepts where they're not investments, but contributions. So you join a community that is developing a drug, where now it's really the onus of that community to start advancing the drug's development, but not in a sense of a traditional investment. We also have models where it is very much a traditional investment. But the underlying thinking is, crowdfunding is kind of like a muddled term in the sense of, I think there's been many approaches to crowdfunding that haven't really worked, and also in the medical space. I think what we're really trying to do is allow the public potentially to benefit from the potential upsides in therapeutics, and not just say, hey, we're funding research because we think it's a great cause. Because I think these donation-based schemes are quite difficult. But that's something that's really, really important to us. Like, how can we allow people to start contributing to the development of these therapeutics much more openly?
Plus, I feel like it makes it easier to work together. It's like kind of setting up a startup. If just like a group gets together and starts working on a molecule, and then everybody has like some of the tokens. Yeah.
It seems like it circles back to the whole ecosystem idea, or like, you know, people can come and join, and everyone, different people at different levels coming together to have something that's more open and honest.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So in some ways, what we're trying to do is to create micro ecosystems around new therapeutics. And ideally, these are really composed of stakeholders, of patients, of researchers that want to advance this. And it's something, if you think about this historically, as a patient, you have no access whatsoever almost to early drug development or even to later stage drug development. It's something, you go to a pharmacy and you're told the therapeutic, this cancer drug that your doctor prescribed, God forbid that you have cancer, but is going to cost you $50,000. Your insurance company is going to cover 20%, and that's it. Like, you have no say in that process whatsoever. And I think that's something that we're really trying to change. So, for example, what if you had a diabetic drug or like a form of insulin that was majority owned by diabetics? Like, what would that do to access of that insulin? What would it do to pricing? Because those patients would just want, they wouldn't want to like have a crazy return on investment. They would just want to get the medicine to lead a happy life. And I think that's kind of the way it should be.
Very idealized, very, very philosophical. And I feel like it comes from the right place. That's the way you're explaining things the way they should be. Well, Paul, thank you so much for the time. Florian, do you have any more questions before we wrap it on up?
I think most of the stuff I had on top of my head was covered. Yeah. Thanks so much for all the insights.
Yeah, likewise, Florian and Connor, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Really love what you're doing. I think Satoshi's Mind is a really cool name and a cool podcast. Hope good things keep coming your way. And Connor, welcome to the ecosystem.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been a good welcome so far. Thanks so much for listening to Satoshi's Mind with our guest, Paul Kohlhaas. You can find Paul on Twitter at PaulKHLS. You can also find his company Molecule on Twitter at Molecule_TO. Follow Nakamoto on Twitter at S_Nakamoto_TO. This show's handle is at Satoshi's_mind. And make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening, and catch new episodes every other Thursday. Thanks so much.